Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the state of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. Anyone who is standing may be seated. Appreciate that very much. And good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is State versus Jennings. We will begin by members of the court introducing themselves, and then we will recognize counsel and we will begin arguments. My name is Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and by seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will now introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Good morning, Stephanie Stacy.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik. Good morning.
And John Frydenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Ms. Dvorak, are you with us this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, good morning to you. And Ms. Faust, are you with us this morning?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
No.
Again, thank you, Ms. Dvorak. Again, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would request to reserve 1 minute of rebuttal. I please the court. My name is Mary Dvorak. I'm an assistant Douglas County Public Defender, and I represent Douglas Jennings. In this case, this is a speedy trial issue. In this case, the complaint was filed in county court in August of 2018. The state had the burden to bring Mr. Jennings to trial within 6 months, which would have been February 2019, unless there are any excludable periods. It's undisputed that there were no court proceedings during that period. No court date set, no trial date set. There was no action in this case until execution of the warrant on May 29th, 2019. There was no record of any attempts to execute the warrant or locate Mr. Jennings until May 29th, 2019. It is clear that the state did not meet its burden to bring Mr. Jennings to trial by that date in February of 2019. Moreover, the state did not meet its burden to show any excludable periods that would extend the time for trial under Nebraska Revised Statute 29-1207.
Counsel, do the waiver provisions of 29-1207 sub 4 sub B have any impact on our analysis in this case?
Well, I believe it does in the sense that that period or that subsection is what the state relied on in its motion to discharge, in its response to my motion to discharge.
Did your client waive the speedy trial right under subsection 4B?
Did he waive it under 4B? Oh, relating to continuance? So,
correct.
I think that there were a few continuances in the case once proceedings were instituted. However, I don't think that those constitute a waiver of the speedy trial. Primarily, first of all, he never explicitly waived his right to speedy trial. Secondly, by the time any of those continuances were made, his period had already run. So his period, his speedy trial, his 6 month period ran in February of 2019. So any continuance that he consented to after that period would not have, you know, been the continuance that put him over that 6 month mark.
So it's your position, that any continuance that was requested that took the trial date out beyond the 6 months is irrelevant, is factually irrelevant in this case.
In this case, I think that the speedy trial had already run at the point that he made any continuances.
Thank you.
So any continuance didn't affect, didn't waive his speedy trial right, that had already run.
Counsel, how would you respond to the state's argument that you've not assigned error to the district court?
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge, I would point to this court's opinion in Keenan, where this court held that the assignment of error where in the brief it's clear that the substantive issue that I'm addressing arose out of a proceeding in the county court. A district court sat as an intermediate appellate court, and you know, whether my assignment of error was, you know, inartfully termed as addressing the error in the county court, that was sufficient in Keenan to preserve the error. I think further fixating on that specific terminology in the assignment of error, you know, fails to recognize it in the rest of the brief. It's clear I make note of, you know, the procedural history of the case, that yes, this went through the district court. The district court, technically speaking, was the last court to address this case. And so, yes, this court is reviewing the district court's affirmation of the county court's, holding. So I think that under the court's jurisprudence, that, you know, that jurisdictional argument is without merit.
Keenan is a court of appeals case, correct?
That is true. However, I would note that this court has referred to it in its own orders, and so I would think that that this court, you know, abides by that principle, or at least doesn't oppose it.
The state relies on our opinion in McGinn for this jurisdictional argument. Would you want to try to attempt to distinguish McGinn?
I don't know that I could speak to that at this time. However, if this is something that the court would want me to brief, I could certainly submit a supplemental brief on the matter. So the state, in its objection or in its response to Mr. Jones' motion to discharge, relied entirely on that subsection D, the period of delay resulting from the absence or unavailability of the defendant. So to some other points, as far as, you know, whether there was any waiver of speedy trial, that was never raised by the state. And I would ask that the court not assert arguments that the state has never presented at the county court level, never presented on appeal. Further, it's clear that under this court's jurisprudence, in all cases involving that subsection, before allowing a period of delay to be attributed to the defendant, have required legal notice. So the cases interpreting that subsection involve the defendant being absent from court proceedings that have been scheduled, or being unavailable for court proceedings that they've been required to attend. So, for example, Richter, that involved proceedings that the defendant missed because he had no formal notice of them. And Chapman, this court's most recent opinion, similarly involved a missed arraignment that the state failed to show that the defendant had legal or actual notice of. Here, there were no court proceedings, so there was nothing scheduled for the defendant to be absent or unavailable from. So he can't be absent or unavailable for purposes of the statute. I think Chapman is particularly applicable here, in how it explains the potential exception to the rule that notice is required. Because in Chapman, this court held that under Richter, the pendency of an arrest warrant alone can result in excluded time only if the state proves it used diligent efforts to serve that warrant. And here, there's no evidence that the state attempted to execute the warrant or even to reach Mr. Jennings to advise him regarding the existence of the warrant and the initiation of criminal proceedings against him before the warrant was executed in May of 2019, 9 months after the complaint was filed. So I think in addition, you know, supported by Chapman and Richter, this result is compelled by the plain language of the statute itself. This delay could not have resulted from defendant's absence because there's no evidence that the state ever tried to execute the warrant before May 29th, 2019. So during the 6 month period that the state could have executed that warrant and had time to prosecute Mr. Jennings from August, 2018 to February, 2019, there's no evidence of any attempt to locate him. There was no attempt to execute that warrant. So that delay, which is really the delay that matters, can't result from the defendant's location at all. It doesn't matter where he was. It doesn't matter if he was in Omaha, if he was in Lincoln, if he was on the moon. If the state doesn't try to get you, it doesn't matter where you were. It did that. His absence, his location didn't result in the delay, the 6 month delay that is dispositive here. With that, I'd ask the court find that the county court and district court erred in overruling Mr. Jennings' motion to discharge, and we would ask that this court reverse those judgments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning again to you, and you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stacey Faust. I'm an assistant attorney general representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska. The defendant assigns one error and is with regards to the county court. Under Nebraska Revised Statute, Section 252733, subparagraph 3, the judgment of the district court vacates the judgment in the county court, and thus only the district court's judgment is reviewable by this court. That is what this court said in State versus McGinn. It's clear, it's unambiguous. There's one judgment, it's the district court judgment. The county court judgment has been vacated.
I beg your pardon. Am I correct? Is this a correct reading of the assignment of error? County court erred in denying Jennings' motion to discharge the stalking charge. The district court affirmed the judgment of the county court. Is that the assignment to which we're referring?
No, the assignment of error is the county court erred in interpreting and applying the speedy trial statute 29-1207 in denying Jennings' motion to discharge, where the state failed to show that Jennings had notice of the pending charge or arrest warrant. There is no mention of what the district court did.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If we disagree with the state's interpretation of the consequences of the language in McGinn, what is the state's position on the actual speedy trial, on the merits of the speedy trial claim raised here? Because your briefing didn't address it. I want to give you an opportunity now, if you have a position on the merits, to let us know what those are.
My position is that I don't think the state met 4D. I agree with counsel. By the time that the warrant was served, the time had passed. Frankly, we don't get to the merits. I don't see how we can with the state of the law with McGinn.
Thank you.
And because that's my position, there are two courts below who disagreed with me. And so I certainly don't see how it rises to the level of plain error. It may be error, in my opinion, but two courts disagree with me. So, and this court may disagree with me.
but anytime we notice plain error, somebody made a mistake, right?
Sure. I mean, but it has to, plain error is different than just error, right? And the definition of plain error encompasses that it was uncomplained of. It's never been asserted. This is this exact argument, not just the violation of the speedy trial statute, but this exact argument has been raised at every single level of these proceedings. It doesn't meet the definition.
You're working on the definition of plain error. The first phrase customarily was uncomplained of.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then our analysis would stop there.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The Court of Appeals in Keenan has not agreed with your reading of our opinion in McGinn. How would you respond to the Court of Appeals decision in Keenan?
Well, I understand the Court of Appeals did not agree with our position in Keenan, but it did agree with our position earlier in a case called State versus ACL. And I guess there is a confusion with the state. We don't know where we lie. We don't know how we are supposed to approach assignments of error that are only with regards to the county court judgment. Because at one time, actually the first time, the Court of Appeals agreed with us. They agreed with us that they could not review a county court error, assigned error. And we don't know what changed after that, other than they started in Keenan and another case, the Court of Appeals changed course. And the court distinguished the procedural postures of those cases with the procedural posture of McGinn, and then found the defendant assigned error to what the Court of Appeals ultimately had to review, which was whether the county court erred. And so the Court of Appeals states, as stated, the defendant adequately preserved the appellant, claim. But that doesn't work. It doesn't work because, one, McGinn says there's no county court judgment to review. Two, like I said before, what changed since Maciel? Nothing. McGinn controls.
Has the Court of Appeals overruled this court?
It can't. Yeah, I mean, and I presume that's maybe why this case was pulled. Because we stood our ground. And it says, for those first two reasons, and third, assigned errors aren't supposed to adequately preserve claims. It's not whether or not they're good enough. They have to be assigned with specificity, and is a prime example of that.
So under the, I beg your pardon, so in terms of how this works in real life and judicial administration, is the state's position that you are not informed of what the appellant has in mind? Are you surprised about what is on deck?
Absolutely not. The state has no problem going back to, we get it, right? I mean, district court is saying exactly what the county court said. We know what it means. Then the language in McGinn needs to be disavowed. Because right now, McGinn controls, and there's one judgment. It's a district court judgment. The state was faulted in McGinn and lost that case because this court said the state could have appealed, didn't, and therefore didn't assign error. So we're not looking at it. We're not looking at your argument, state, because we're only here on the district court judgment, and you didn't appeal like you could have and assign error as you should have. It's no different. The rules, the state's position, the rules have to be applied fairly to both sides. And here, he appealed. He could have assigned error and should have. McGinn's been out there to the district court judgment, and he didn't.
So let's set aside McGinn hypothetically, set aside Keenan, set aside all the precedent. In the state's view, what's the best rule for this situation?
Go back to the way it was, where everybody understands that where a district court acted as an intermediate appellate court, and unless the district court does something different, whereas an assigned error really only is as to that judgment, we can look at the county court judgment, and we should, because that's what we're looking through to. And if that's the case, like in McGinn, where the defendant makes assignments of error to the county court judgment, we should be able to respond and say the county court judgment actually was correct, Ergo, the district court was correct in affirming because there's no difference between McGinn and all the cases that the Court of Appeals has heard. They've all been affirmances. And so that's really all the state is saying in response is actually, no, you're wrong, appellant. The county court judgment was correct. And therefore, ergo, the district court was correct in affirming, no matter the reason that the district court did.
Ms. Faust, with respect to your argument about going back to the way it was, I think is the way you described it. How would that apply in the situation where a county court decides an issue and a district court takes that specific issue and affirms it in part, but in part modifies or reverses it? How would your articulation apply to that situation?
Well, I guess then the district court judgment is split, right? It's not an all on board affirmance like in McGinn, which McGinn was. And so I do feel the state could have said right result, wrong reason. Assuming that it stands that the state has a right to appeal, and obviously the defendant does too, then there should be a specific assignment of error as to what the district court did.
So in my hypothetical, you would propose that the proper assignment of error should be that the district court made a mistake in what it did to the extent that they disagree, the county court may, there'd be separate assignments of error. Is I think what you're articulating, is that right?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
And I beg your pardon, and could you remind me what was the notice of appeal? To what order was an appeal taken? From which order is an appeal taken?
In this case?
Yeah, to bring it to the appellate, to the Court of Appeals. Oh. I beg your pardon. We're getting a lot of layers here. I beg your pardon. Okay. The notice of appeal that brought it to the Nebraska Court of Appeals and thereafter transferred to us. What was the indication on the notice of appeal from attacking which order? Thank you.
I don't know what the substance of the notice of appeal said, but it had to have been the district court affirming the order of the county court, because district court as an intermediate appellate court. And in opposing counsel's brief, the statement of case, she does outline that, but in the assignment of error and nowhere in the argument, is there discussion about what the district court did? None. I believe I've addressed both McKinn and the plain error, and I'm out of time. So, further questions? Sorry.
You are indeed out of time, Ms. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We ask that you affirm.
Do we have any time for rebuttal?
38 seconds.
We have 38 seconds, Ms. Rourke.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did have an opportunity to review CNN, and it appears, you know, this court can obviously review that as well in making its own decision, but, you know, it does draw the distinction that in McGinn, the reason that the assigned appeal, that the assigned error was not sufficient was because it was in relation to a cross appeal, which is not the case here. I would just note that the state has conceded that he win on the merits. I would also note that, yes, while Keenan is a court of appeals case, when I wrote this brief, this case was pending in the Court of Appeals. And so that assignment of error would have been sufficient under the Court of Appeals jurisprudence. It would be fundamentally unfair to then say your meritorious appeal is being kicked out because this case got put onto the Supreme Court docket, when that would have, that assignment of error would have been sufficient under the Court of Appeals standard.
Don't you,
I would,
Don't you know when you file an appeal to the Court of Appeals that there's always the possibility that it may end up in the Supreme Court?
That's true. That's true.
So shouldn't you write the brief that way?
I should have. But what I'm saying is, you know, there's a million ways I could have made this brief better. But fortunately for me, as a public defender, I just need to do, not that I just need to do, but I guess I'm kind of being flippant in, you know, I'm not trying to get an A+ here. All I want is for you, this court, to reach the merits of my appeal. Could I have written this better? Yes. Would I have changed the wording in that error, in that assignment of error? 100%, and eliminated this whole issue. But I think the way that my brief was written and the what has been preserved in the brief and in all of the appellate documents has been to put the state on notice as far as what we're appealing. And the reason I didn't spend a lot of time on the district court's order is that it does not address the merits. The district court's order is in the transcript. You know, it's before this court. It does not address. It's not as if the district court did some reasoning as far as my speedy trial argument that I thought bore on this. You know, the district court just affirmed by order without any analysis.
Can we overturn the county court decision without overturning the district court decision?
No, of course. You need to technically overturn the district court's decision. That's what this court needs to do. And so, yes, if it's inartfully affirmed, but I think that there isn't confusion about, you know, on the entirety of the record what it is that this court, what we're asking this court to do.
Going back, if I may, to the notice of appeal, is this correct that it doesn't refer to a date in an order, but rather it says that the county court denied the motion to discharge and the district court affirmed? Is that correct?
If you give me a second for the...
Thank you.
Why don't you just assume Justice Miller Lerman's quoting from it?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Well, I'm not the author of any of this, so I always put this in the form of a question. But we all know what we're talking about, so thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much, both counsel. That concludes our arguments in State versus Jennings. Counsel, you are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Hawkins versus Delgado.